Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Look, if you missed it the other day, one of the more remarkable things on cable television was Noah Rothman going on Morning Joe to discuss his new book, Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. And we're lucky enough to have Noah with us in a somewhat safer space. So thanks for joining me, Noah.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, you know what? What really struck me is, and I want to talk about the substance of your book, the 30-minute discussion about that was on MSNBC about your book was really unusual for cable television because it was a long form, in depth, I thought relatively intelligent discussion in which you had a variety of points of views expressed pretty well. So it was this was like 2 days for you being on the hot seat there, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was definitely 2 days, and some seats were hotter than others. But I'm extremely grateful to the Morning Joe team and to Joe Scarborough and Mika and everybody over there. They've given me a big platform to discuss the book, and I couldn't be more grateful. It was really enlightening. I thought good debate, and it's definitely good for the book. So I couldn't be happier.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, to have that kind of national television. Of course, you've seen Twitter.
I have seen Twitter. Yeah, it's that can kind of bring you down a peg. Actually, you get out of the studio and you feel like you did pretty good, and then maybe you check your messages and realize, oh, I didn't do that good. Maybe.
Well, what's interesting about Twitter? Twitter has the peculiar language where if there's somebody on you disagree with, and there's somebody on disagree with, they have destroyed the other person. They have dismantled the other person. They have flamed the other person. As opposed to, wow, that was an interesting exchange of views. And of course, you were at a slight disadvantage here because you were trying to make a long form discussion with folks, and we're not going to necessarily, talk about them specifically, but folks who had not read your book. And so they were able to characterize, or they were attempting to characterize, your point of view without actually having read what you wrote about those issues.
Yeah, I mean, some summaries of what I wrote were more accurate than others. There was at one point there were some issues that were brought up that I genuinely didn't write about in the book at all. So I was a little confused as to where they came from. There was apparently some sort of a mismatch on the prep sheet. But, I by and large, there was a discussion of the issues around my book. And while they hadn't read the arguments, which are nuanced in the actual book, we were able to get to the meat of a lot of the contentions that I make in the piece. So I was happy about that.
Yeah. So the book is Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. You've obviously been thinking about this for some time and, talking about the whole social justice movement. Give me a thumbnail sketch of your thesis here, because this comes out at a time when we have the celebration of being woke and increased activism from all of these groups. So in some ways, this is a very, very countercultural book to come out right now.
Yes. Well, I mean, I like many conservatives, have been writing pieces in opposition to the pieties of identity politics for a long time, and I've been looking to compile those into a book form. And it wasn't really until I took a government-sponsored trip to Ukraine that the idea was crystallized for me. I opened it up in the very opening introduction of the book. I talk about how I went over to Ukraine and on this government-sponsored trip, and we sat across from the country's chief prosecutor, who explained to us in perfect English and rather pointedly that this government, the pro-Western government, mind you, the government you support, had no interest or intention to prosecute anybody who was engaged in violence in the Maidan revolution that overthrew the status quo anti-regime, the pro-Russian regime, because they were on their side. And you should be. And this is just the way things work. And this is sort of the nature of politics in Ukraine, which is not a Republican culture, although it aspires to be one, and I hope it is soon. But it was a kind of a dangerous politics in my mind, a retributive politics, a post-revolutionary politics that views individuals as members of groups, and that the kind of justice that they apply is much more tribal and politically motivated and has very little to do with the conduct of justice as we understand it in a courtroom here. And that's the kind of culture that I think we are incubating through the social justice movement, which is identity politics in practice. It is a governing ethos, an alternative theory of societal organization, one that is very retributive, vengeful, and disdainful of individual merit and autonomy and agency. And it's something that I believe needs to be resisted, and that's the thesis of this book.
So do you envision going back to, again, using shorthand, a colorblind society where we don't actually look at the historic disadvantages of certain groups or that we should actually strive to ignore those distinctions?
Well, certainly, again, the arguments in the book are rather nuanced, and I am sympathetic to the idea that is propounded by the advocates of this particular philosophy, that it is simply morally obtuse to see historical injustices and fail to view them through the prism that they need to be viewed by, which is individuals or collective groups who are oppressed and subjugated by a distinct and circumspect set of other individuals. And to fail to acknowledge who's the oppressor and who's doing the oppression is simply counterproductive if you're seeking to mm-hmm. apply justice in a cosmic sense, which has very little to do with the kind of good justice that is applied in the courtroom. That is, however, a radical departure from social justice as we understand it in theory, in the kind of social justice that was espoused by individuals like John Rawls, who is the philosophical father of this movement. He postulated that we can begin to think about justice in a karmic sense as sort of a finite commodity, and that it exists, and if one has it, then one does not. And so it needs to be distributed, and then the distributor must be an enlightened individual, of course, but how does he acquire enlightenment? And that is through a theoretical construct that John Rawls adopted, which called what he called the veil of ignorance.
Right.
And if this distributor operated behind this veil, he would not be able to satisfy his own biases. He would not know who was the beneficiary of his distributions. The modern social justice activist disdains the veil, has no use for the veil. The veil is an obstacle to achieving justice, particularly if you are seeking to achieve historical retributive justice, which more or less often takes the form of negative discrimination, social leveling, negative force upon tribes, collectives, groups who are perceived to be the beneficiaries of historical privilege, whether they know it or not, and to rise up those who have been the victims of that privilege. So this is a significant departure from the kind of justice that was envisioned by John Rawls. It's much more retributive, a little bit more vengeful, and it looks a lot more like an attack on luck and fortune. And it results in quite a few other antipathies towards the sort of stuff that we would think of as just really basic egalitarian principles that are the basis of the American experiment. Things like meritocracy and individual agency and colorblindness, and even like basic English common law concepts like the presumption of innocence. These are obstacles to achieving true historical justice. So it's a substantial departure from the philosophical basis that social justice activists may not even be aware is their philosophical foundations.
Okay, so how do you respond to people who would say, and I'm going back to Twitter, that you are white privilege personified, that what you are trying to do is to rationalize white privilege, and talk about the word privilege and the fact that has become the go-to word among social justice advocates.
Yeah, I mean, as a concept, it's worth exploring. As an epithet, it's far less edifying and sort of not really worth engaging. I mean, the notion that for this particular cohort, which is obsessed with identity and is very interested in historical grievances and getting history right in those terms, for somebody like me with a blaringly Jewish last name, I think about how far we've come. The fact that that doesn't register with these particular individuals for whom experience suffices for identity and identity suffices for ideology, that they don't recognize that strikes me as an interesting blind spot. But it also doesn't matter. I am not arguing as anyone. I'm not arguing as an Irish, German, half-Catholic, half-Jewish, heterosexual man from New Jersey. I'm arguing as an American with ideas, and the ideas speak for themselves. And you can engage with those ideas if you like. But for those who want to argue against me and don't have answers to the ideas that I'm raising and the concepts that I'm espousing, we'll seek to undermine that by appealing to identity, by saying that you simply do not have the experience to opine on this with any authority.
And of course, that's the way almost every one of these discussions seems to devolve. So all of this, of course, is wrapped in the culture of victimization, which I think we've been wrestling with for several decades. Your take on the way in which you have folks on the right who seem to have embraced the same culture of victimization and ethnic identity that you know, back in the 1990s, we saw this kind of identity politics and the power of being a victim and, you know, the moral authority of all of that. And more recently, I'd like your take on say what Tucker Carlson is doing, where he's basically saying to the white working class, you know, you should also practice a form of identity politics, and that should also be predicated on the fact that you are a victim.
Yeah, it's a species of a very similar form of social justice, and I don't make much of a distinction between social justice activists on the right and the left. To me, they are very much the same phenomenon, reflections of one another in a funhouse mirror. The movement that was a noble movement, the social justice movement, is centuries old and deep philosophical foundations, has been corrupted by these ideas about thinking that you are a victim put upon by ill-defined forces that have put obstacles on your path to success, that have robbed from you your due, that separatism is necessary and a necessary good because it prevents social discomfort. And colorblindness is simply an obtuse way to go about life. These are the things that social justice activists on the left believe, but it's also what white supremacists believe. Mm-hmm. These are paralyzing lies. They render their adherents paranoid and bitter, and they're obstacles, frankly, to achieving the kind of social progress that we all want, to combat discrimination and institutional prejudice, and the kind that does affect the working white class for whom Tucker Carlson supposedly speaks, but also for American minorities and women and just about anybody who's faced discrimination historically. And this is – you're simply advocating bigotry. Mm-hmm. To me, the cure for the ills of bigotry is not more bigotry.
But are you suggesting a moral equivalency between social justice activists and white supremacists, neo-Nazis? There's parallels, but is there, you know?
I'm not a moral equivalency. Mm-hmm. I am suggesting an equivalency in outlook and in tactics. I do see much more similarities there. I don't think that there is a moral relativism that you can apply to the, particularly given the historic and obvious and egregious sins against fellow man and comedy and the social compact that have been executed by white supremacists over the course of history. To fail to acknowledge that would be blind. But the separatism and the antipathy towards really basic fundamental notions of American fairness and egalitarianism and individual worth and individual potential are to me distinctly similar. And the victimhood mentality that you identified there, that both sides wallow in, is paralyzing and also results in a kind of paranoia that has manifested in actions that both of these groups are taking in the streets. And both of them are now at each other's throats. And that's probably a natural outgrowth of the fact that they believe each other to be diametrically opposed to one another, but it's almost the narcissism of small differences. There's such rare distinction in between the two of them tactically that they are very much aware of each other's differences, much more than their similarities.
So let's circle back to the point that you were making before, that inevitably, and you got this during your on-air discussion as well, that you can't possibly know what you're talking about because you are not a member of one of these oppressed, victimized groups, that because you are a privileged white male, you just don't get it, that you need to validate the other experience that you cannot possibly grasp. You're going to get this all the time. So what is the – so you and I were two middle-aged – well, I'm middle-aged. You're a kid. you know, white guys talking about race and justice. What do we know?
Yeah. So this is something that Joe said today, which I think is pretty apt, that everybody wants to have an honest conversation about race and theory. And then it happens, and it's much more uncomfortable than we all thought it would be, because it turns out we don't necessarily agree.
I thought that was a great point.
But it's necessary. Yeah. It's absolutely necessary. And I welcome the kind of pushback that I received this morning. I am taking this message to quarters that are not amenable to the message in my book, that don't think identity politics is not a negative force in American life, but a positive force and a perennial force. All politics, in the eyes of many a social justice activist, can be boiled down to identity politics, particularly on the right and on the left. They bristle at, and I agree with them, that they don't see conservatives attacking white identity politics for what it is, for what conservatives engage in when they engage in identity politics. And they have a very good point when they attack the conservative myopia, or the blind spot, rather, on that end of things. However, I do take issue with the fact, the perception that you raise, which is that I cannot opine on issues that I have no personal mm-hmm. lived experience right. with. If that was the case, there would be a whole host of policy matters unrelated to identity that none of us could opine on, and that would result in some rather paralytic politics. Of course, we can opine on issues that we've engaged in, that we've studied. The issue is not experience, but study, but scholarship, and being able to opine on a subject with some authority because you've devoted some time and research to understanding it wholly. That is supposedly what this side of the aisle wants to see from the conservative right. And I'm trying to exemplify that, and I hope I do, but there is a reflexive pushback, I think, from people who simply assume, without having read the arguments in my book, that I couldn't possibly. And they revert in order to distort the argument and to discredit the argument preemptively to saying that I couldn't possibly understand these arguments because I don't share the lived experience. Yeah. That's an uncompelling argument to me.
Well, it also shuts down the argument. It basically says we don't have anything to talk about. You can simply witness from your own perspective. So, you know, one of the things that that I think that we're debating now is, you know, the role of race in American politics, particularly in conservative politics. You know, for years and years and years, the left was accusing everyone who was a conservative, everyone who was a Republican, of being a racist or having racial animosity. You heard a little bit of that again on the show, that, you know, that George Bush is racist, John McCain's racist, Dwight Eisenhower was racist. And I think that on the part of a lot of conservatives, at a certain point, you know, there was that shrugging of the shoulder and saying, whatever, the term had lost any real power. There was so much crying wolf that went on. So there is that moment, though, in the era of Trump where you go back and go, all right, what did we miss? Is racial bias, was it more of a factor than some of us thought? I think that I come from the same school of conservative thought that you do, where I was sort of, you know, was willing to believe that we had put a lot of that in our past, that maybe there were the crazy bigoted uncles, you know, at the end of the bar or whatever, to mix metaphors. But they certainly did not speak for us. And here we are with Donald Trump as president of the United States. So is it, you know, did we in fact underplay the role of race in the movement that we thought we understood at one time?
Yeah, well, I didn't recognize it, unfortunately. It was a lot of things that you and I didn't recognize, yeah. And I think we started to come to terms with how little we understood about the movement of which mm-hmm. we were members. There was the streak of conservatism that I think you and I inhabit, there is much more antipathy towards identity politics, but that was broken down over the course of many decades, but recently over the course of the Obama era, in the same way a lot of resistance to what Donald Trump posited in over the course of the 2016 campaign was broken down, how conservatives had approached politics generally, and that goes with civility and antipathy towards certain really hard to sell concepts like frugality. A lot of that was broken down by Donald Trump's willingness to buck conservative ethos, and identity politics was just one of those pillars. And it's been incumbent on us to examine our history to demonstrate where that message became where that's this organization, this group of people became receptive to that message.
Yeah.
And it has roots in a long history. I try to go into that a little bit in the book. But I'd be lying if I said I fully understood it. I honestly do not, because I do not understand that movement at all. I do criticize it, because I don't think it's valuable or healthy, and it mirrors the kind of vengeful, bitter antipathy that I'm denouncing on the left. I spent a lot of time talking about the authoritarian right, but I don't understand it because I am not a member of it. So in that sense, the right and the left that I'm critiquing share a particular critique of me that I don't fully understand them. I do not, but I do understand that what they're doing is dangerous.
Yeah. So let's talk about this particular moment we're in right now. And I think you and I both feel this, that if we are Trump skeptical, you know, disillusioned by much of what the conservative movement has become, we're accused by the American greatness crowd, the usual suspects of wanting to turn power over to the left. And I think anyone who watched you on Morning Joe or is listening to you realizes that is not where you are. But it is a complicated moment, isn't it? I mean, we are sort of, to use the Aristotelian term, we're kind of screwed here, aren't we? That if in fact we don't have a home on the right as long as the right is Trumpist, but we're certainly not embracing the left, where does that leave people like you, Noah Rothman?
Well, I'm a little bit more optimistic than you, I think.
I hope
part
so.
Of the reason why, and I address in the book why how this is going to be done, but I ultimately don't think that we're seeing any indicators by any metric that Donald Trump's version of Republican politics is popular or politically successful. I struggle to see, in fact, any metric that demonstrates that Donald Trump's version of politics has won a single new convert, and in fact appears to be losing them. And if that is attributable mostly to his identitarian agitations, and I think it is, it's a good thing for the country and a better thing for the conservative movement, because it won't be long before conservatives are going to reconcile with the fact that this horse to whom they've hitched their wagons was a losing one.
At the moment, yeah, but he's got 90% approval rating among Republicans right now, at least for the moment. The people that we had spent a decade or more aligned with have decided, they look at Donald Trump and say, yeah, we're okay with that.
No, I think it's a little lower than that, depending on the poll, but it's still really high.
80.
It's still significantly high. 8 out of 10 is nothing to sneeze at, but the coalition is getting smaller. So you can maintain 80 support of a smaller pool, but it's becoming less and less impressive. And in the event that Donald Trump loses in 2020, and he may, and all bets are off if he does not, if he does, however, then there's going to have to be a reckoning. And it won't be about the economy and performance, about whether or not he delivered the wall. It will be on how he interacted with some of the ethos that Americans hold dear, the colorblind approach to social comity and integration and all of that. And I think it's... It dovetails, I think, with some of the efforts that we've seen in the past. The argument that will be made is, which I posit in the book, is will dovetail with arguments that we've seen in the past, that the people who were attracted to Donald Trump, warts and all, are not the problem, because a lot of those ideas are attractive.
Right.
You are not the issue. Those ideas are the issue, and not because they are bad or wrong, but because they are counterproductive. You and I believe certain things. We want to see certain policies affected in Washington. And to the extent that those ideas are keeping us from doing that, that is a problem. So you might believe them. I might believe them. I don't. But you might, and I might. And that's not wrong. What's wrong here is the fact that you and I can't get done what we want to get done because of those ideas. And so those ideas need to go. A wholly pragmatic argument. And it was essentially the argument that was made over the course of a very circumspect and clever campaign by Bill Buckley and Russell Kirk and Barry Goldwater to oust the Bircher movement. It was the argument that was made by Democrats in the late 1940s to purge communists from the organized labor movement. We have models to
crucial,
which we can appeal.
Crucial on both sides, yeah.
Models to which we can appeal. And those are the models I invoke in the book.
You know, maybe this is an awkward question to ask when we're talking about group identity. But you know, I was as I read through your book and I was listening to you, you know, a thought that I've had for the last 2 years, which is, and I'm sort of getting to this sort of backwards, is that, you know, a lot of us watched what was happening with Trump, and I think we saw something that the other conservative didn't see. And there was always that, like, why don't you see what we are seeing? Why don't you put this in historical context? Why don't you understand what the echoes of, you know, the America First are? And I wonder if, and as you look through the ranks of Trump skeptics, whether or not Jewish conservatives looked at Trump fundamentally differently. Obviously not everyone. You write for Commentary magazine. I look at this and I'm more and more convinced that there's something there, that I grew up in a household. My father was Jewish. My grandparents were Jewish. And whether it was an historical perspective or an ethical perspective, because there does seem to be a divide here, or am I exaggerating that?
No, I think it's fair. And I can tell you where it stems from. For me, I mean, personally, I was frustrated with Donald Trump for years before he came down the escalator. But for a lot of Jewish conservatives who were opposed to Donald Trump early on, they did so because of his antipathies towards some really basic notions about what the conservative movement was about: frugality, fairness, and identitarian agitation. And he had been a birther long before this. American conservative Jews are a little sensitive, I think, more so than others, to identity politics agitation on the right, because they've usually been targets of it. And that was pretty evident early on in Trump's campaign, right around September mm-hmm. of 2015, when his flirtation with the most noxious white nationalist elements of the Republican Party gave them license to come out of the shadows. And all of us were the target of some really noxious, vile attacks on us personally, on our families, insults, threats, illustrations of Jews being executed and shot in the back of the head, that sort of thing. All of us experienced it, some worse than
others. That was shocking at the time. I mean, not to downplay. I mean, I remember when I first got the meme of, you know, my face being in a gas chamber where he's pressing the button. Mm-hmm. These are the things that you know, perhaps had been latent out there, you know, and had been given, you know, some oxygen by this.
Yeah, and I don't want to oversell the scope of the problem. I mean, this was a small cohort of people, but that small cohort of people was absolutely given license to do what they did by Donald Trump's reckless agitation and flirtation with these sentiments. And he shouldn't be let off the hook for that. That sentiment has to be expunged from the Republican coalition, not just for the sake of political salience and relevance, although that is part of it, but for just a basic human decency and morality. These sort of things cannot go ignored.
Yeah, and by the way, when I'm asking about Jewish criticism of Donald Trump, that this is not, I don't think, a code word for neoconservative either, because that I think is a separate issue. I do think that there is something a little bit deeper that went on there. You know, Noah, you and I also have something else in common. We are both what's known as MSNBC conservatives. And I mentioned you before we started this. What's always striking to me is that there is that moment when the MSNBC, you know, shall we say, universe discovers that you're still a conservative, that there's genuine surprise. So are you at all concerned that your strange new respect that you've been enjoying as a Trump skeptic is now at risk, that you have come out with this conservative critique of social justice warriors?
I mean, maybe. I survey my back to Twitter. I survey my mentions just about every time I'm on, and I never really, I never see that new respect materialize in any real form. It seems like for the most part, I mean, that most of the viewers are great, and most of the audience is fantastic. But the very fact that you are a conservative does tend to frustrate people who don't like conservatives. I mean, that's pretty natural. I think the network is fantastic, and everybody on the network
is fantastic.
And the decisions that they're making, the decisions that they're making to take on some people like Bret Stephens and John Budhoritz and some really important thinkers in the conservative movement, of whom I'm very privileged to be a very, very small part of this team. I love the opportunity. I think it's a very smart business strategy, because there will be a time after Trump, and there will be a conservative movement after Trump, and the cult of personality around him that you and I see is unsustainable, because it won't be around forever. There has to be some ideological meat on these bones when he's gone. And so everybody who is a Trump skeptic now is better positioned than I think their detractors think to inherit the movement, insofar as they have an ideology that is duplicable, that you don't have to have a cult of personality around in order to understand and replicate. Donald Trump's personality is so mercurial that it's very difficult to know what he's going to say one day or the other. And if he doesn't have any ideological predilections that you can mirror and have some foresight as to what he's going to say next, it's going to be very difficult for that movement to survive after him.
Well, you know, there's another side to this as well. And by the way, I wanted to echo what you had to say there, that, you know, in the 2 years that I've been with MSNBC, they've been nothing but classy. They have been nothing but supportive. There's not been a single moment when there has been any pressure to, you know, change my position on the issue or any line. And of course, you know, you have to, you know, take the this line that somehow you have sold out or you are pandering to the MSNBC crowd. But I do think it's valuable. And I think you illustrated this the other day, that there's a real value in exposing, you know, the, shall we say, the left of center audience of MSNBC to intelligent, principled, thoughtful conservatism. That there is a point of which that outreach to articulate those ideas, to make the case that Donald Trump is not the be-all and the end-all of the conservative movement. I think there's a real value to that. Now, not everyone's going to appreciate that, but, you know, the reaction that I get that I you know, value the most are, you know, people will say, you know, I'd never heard that position articulated that way. I'd never heard that idea expressed in that way. You've made me think about it differently. And I'm guessing that after your discussion of your book, you know, that once, you know, the Twitter storm dies down, that there will be people who will sit back and think, you know, that is a legitimate point of view. And we do need to keep that political dialogue going, because that political dialogue is going to continue long after Donald Trump leaves the scene.
Yeah, I hope so. I completely agree with you. And one of the things that I think MSNBC does really well these days is that it is positioned to discuss policy in a way that I don't think anybody else in the business really is. It doesn't really move the needle. It's kind of boring. And in this era of Twitter-fied politics, you want to appeal to the most engaged and energetic base you can. And that sort of nuance just really leaves a lot of people cold. So it's a big investment in what I think is a project that's necessary for just basic civic education and important from a political perspective. But as you said, you know, I hope this book survives again the Twitter feud right now that's boiling around it, which is good for a sugar high in sales, but I don't know how much it's going to be good for the long term. I hope it is, because the arguments in the book are dangerous. I'm tap dancing all over a lot of third rails, and I know it. It was part of the reason why, you know, I wanted to do it as my first book. I didn't want to put out anything anodyne and boring and something that people would forget, but also because there's a lot of things that I think really need to be said, and there are consequences for saying them. And I understand that I'm not trying to martyr myself in here, but there's a risk.
There are real consequences.
What you're saying can be mischaracterized or misconstrued, and that misconstruction can take hold in the public imagination, and that sometimes is all it takes. So I do understand that and recognize that, and I'm very fortunate that I was able to put this book in front of a lot of people who I trust and respect and who are important in this world of political commentary, who gave it their imprimatur, and hopefully that is enough to give people the permission to explore these ideas that you really can't say in polite company anymore for fear of what might happen to you, because they really do need to be explored in a much more open fashion and a fashion without fear of consequences for them. Well, so that's my fondest hope.
Yeah, my hat's off to you. And I said to my wife this morning when I was looking at this, I said, boy, Noah Rothman has got my respect, because that is a gutsy move, because, you know, to argue the logic and the history and all of this in an environment where you can be flamed by the emotional appeal It is not a level playing field. And Noah Rothman, thank you so much for spending some time with me, and thank you for the book. And hopefully we can continue this this discussion over the next couple of years. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I sincerely appreciate it.